It is my distinct honor to introduce our distinguished moderator for our final panel, Judge Chad Radler. Judge Radler earned his undergraduate and law degrees from the University of Michigan. After graduating, he served as a law clerk to Judge Alan Norris of the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Judge Radler then began practicing law in the Columbus office of Jones Day, eventually spending 10 years as a partner there in the firm's Issues and Appeals Group. While at the firm, he appeared in state and federal trial and appellate courts around the country, most frequently the Supreme Court of Ohio and the Sixth Circuit. Judge Radler also successfully argued before the United States Supreme Court in McQuiggan v. Perkins on behalf of an inmate claiming actual innocence. His other pro bono representations include representing capital defendants before the 10th Circuit and the Supreme Court of Ohio, as well as representing defendants sentenced to life in prison before the Sixth Circuit. While at Jones Day, Judge Radler also traveled to Nairobi with Lawyers Without Borders to train Kenyan lawyers on prosecuting domestic violence cases. And he was also a recipient of the American Marshall Memorial Fellowship awarded by the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Following his career in private practice, Judge Radler served as Acting Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division of the United States Department of Justice from 2017 to 2019. In that role, Judge Radler led and supervised over 1,000 lawyers in the department's largest litigating division, briefing and arguing several cases on behalf of the United States and federal courts across the country, including high-profile cases significant to both the administration and the department. In March 2019, Judge Radler was confirmed to serve on the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and with a man with that much varied and interesting background, I think the most interesting thing is a double Michigan man who has decided to reside in Columbus. Thank you, Judge Radler.
Great, Joey, thank you very much. No one should complain after such a gracious introduction, but there's one item you left out, and that is I am the former president of the Columbus Lawyers Chapter of the Federal Society. And I guess unlike Judge Knapp, that was on my resume before my confirmation hearing. But all's well that ends well. And let me just say, having been the president when the organization was much smaller, it's just wonderful to see how things have graduated, to see all of you here today. It's really a tribute to the organization, and I also congratulate Lisa and the whole team who put this together. This is a wonderful panel. I suspect the novelty of seeing a Sixth Circuit judge is now worn off. I'm the fourth one on the roster today, but happily I have a really terrific panel that really rivals any panel you would see at the national convention. And so it's my privilege to introduce the topic, introduce them, and hopefully foster a discussion about departmentalism. As judges, we're asked routinely to decide whether a law is enforceable, whether it's constitutional, how the law should be interpreted. But our question today is whether another branch of government, the executive branch, should be doing something of the same task. There's a couple of questions in your program that kind of tee up the issues for us. Whether state executives and attorney generals, what role they play in interpreting laws, and how do the duties to defend laws and the duties to enforce laws extend to those branches? Our three speakers, I'm going to introduce them in alphabetical order. First up is Professor Jonathan Adler. Professor Adler is a professor of law and the director of the Coleman Bjerk Center for the Environmental Law at the Case Western Reserve University School of Law, where he teaches courses in environmental, administrative, and constitutional law. He's the author of editor of seven books, including Business in the Roberts Court, published in 2016, and his articles appeared in publications from journals at Harvard and Yale Law Schools to the Wall Street Journal and USA Today. He's a contributing editor to the National Review Online, and probably as many of you also know, a regular contributor to the popular blog, The Volokh Conspiracy. In 2007, a Case Western alumni group named Professor Adler their Distinguished Teacher of the Year. He's a former law clerk to Judge David Sentell of the DC Circuit, and he is a honors graduate of Yale University and the George Mason University School of Law. Ed Whalen. Ed Whalen is a distinguished senior fellow of the Ethics and Public Policy Center and holds EPPC's Antonin Scalia Chair in Constitutional Studies. Just as one tip, you can count how many times I mentioned Justice Scalia in this introduction. I think it's at least three. Mr. Whalen directs EPPC's program on the Constitution, the courts, and the culture. His areas of expertise include constitutional law and the judicial confirmation process. As a contributor to National Review Online's bench memos, Mr. Whalen comments on topics like nominations to the Supreme Court and the lower courts and areas of constitutional law. And I think he's quite well known for his column, This Day in Liberal Judicial Activism. Sometimes I think that phrase is redundant, but it's always an interesting column to read. Mr. Whalen is also the editor of three volumes of the Supreme Court's works of Justice Scalia. The most recent of those is The Essential Scalia on the Constitution, the Courts, and the Rule of Law, which was published in 2020. It's a collection of Justice Scalia's views on legal issues, and of course, his co-editor was Chief Judge Sutton. Mr. Whalen is a former law clerk to Justice Scalia, and he's also worked in every branch of government, including as the Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel, and he is a graduate with honors from Harvard College and Harvard Law School. And we're also very fortunate to have with us Ohio's 51st Attorney General, Dave Yost. Dave Yost took office in January 2019, bringing to the office experience in rooting out fraud, holding the corrupt accountable, and reforming government. General Yost earned his undergraduate degree from The Ohio State University and his law degree from Capital University. After working as a Columbus Citizen Journal reporter, he began his public service career as Delaware County's auditor and prosecutor. As prosecutor, he won the first ever capital case in Delaware County and took down the largest drug ring in county history. He became Ohio's 32nd Auditor of State in January 2011. In two terms, he helped convict 170 corrupt public officials and uncovered $30 million in stolen and misspent public funds. And at the same time, he identified potential savings of nearly $300 million for governments and school districts across
the
state.
Your Honor, we'll wait formal reading.
I'm gonna grant myself one more minute of time to finish. I just want to know, as Attorney General, your priorities have been protecting Ohio citizens in the areas of opioid epidemic, standing up for victims of human trafficking, solving cold case homicides and sexual assaults, and shielding Ohio consumers from scammers and robocallers. And we're proud to say that General Yost and his wife, Darlene, make their home here in Franklin County. So with that, I think Professor Adler is going to start off our conversation, maybe with some background principles on the concept of departmentalism.
Great. Well, thank you, Judge Riedler. It's a real pleasure to be here. I was talking earlier about how great it is to be in together with this group again, and it's quite, at least in my own case, seems quite fitting, because the last talk I gave to a group in public was, I believe, March 3rd of last year, which was to the Cincinnati chapter of the Federalist Society, to talk about my book, Marijuana Federalism, Uncle Sam and Mary Jane, available through Amazon and other fine retailers. It's really great to be able to have this opportunity to be back with this group and to be back discussing these ideas, and really was thrilled to be here. So just wanted to say that. And in terms of our subject today, I'm going to lay out a little bit about departmentalism, why it's a thing, it should be a thing, why it's an important aspect of our constitutional design. And then, but I'll be relatively brief, because we want to have some back and forth on the panel in terms of what happens when the rubber meets the road with regard to departmentalism. So often when we're talking about constitutional questions and we ask, is something constitutional, a lot of times what we really mean is, what are the courts going to do with it? Where are five votes going to fall on the Supreme Court? And as a practical matter, that makes some sense. If you're a legislator and you want to vote for a piece of legislation, you'd like to know whether it's going to be able to be enforced. If you're working for an executive branch agency, you would like to know, are the actions we are going to take today going to, in fact, be upheld? So it's understandable that we're concerned about what the judiciary is or is not going to do. But the way we tend to talk about it, is this constitutional, is kind of wrong, right? Because we're not asking, is it constitutional? We're asking, what is some other group going to say about whether it's constitutional? And you know, the Supreme Court is not final because it's always right. It's right, or we have to accept that they're right because they're always final, right? The Supreme Court is an institution made up of people. It is fallible. It can reach a judgment about what is constitutional. That is wrong. And as we all know throughout its history, it has done so, often with quite tragic results. So the way we talk about constitutional often obscures something about the nature of our Constitution. And if you certainly believe that there is a constitutional meaning, that if you believe that when the words were written and affixed to paper and ratified, that their meaning was set, then when we're asking, is it constitutional, or we should be asking a different question than what courts will or will not do for it. And if we think about how the government operates, this should become clearer to us, because the reality is there are lots of constitutional questions that do not, and in fact, in many cases, cannot be resolved by courts. That not every clause in the Constitution is justiciable. Not every clause in the Constitution is amenable to a suit to be being brought by someone who has Article III standing. That doesn't mean there aren't real constitutional questions. It means that it is not within the province of the judiciary to, in the context of a dispute, resolve that particular dispute. And so we expect members of Congress, if they are considering an impeachment resolution or considering whether to convict someone of high crimes and misdemeanors, to take seriously the question of what is a high crime or misdemeanor, and whether or not a particular public official has engaged in that action. And we know that no court is going to disturb that judgment. There's a guy named Nixon, I have to remind my students, not the one you may have heard of, not Richard Walter Nixon, who actually asked the Supreme Court to weigh in on what constitutes a trial of in the Senate. The Supreme Court said, we're not going to touch that. I think it was Justice Souter who wrote in concurrence saying, well, surely if they were like, you know, doing it by coin toss. But no, that was a concurrence. The majority wouldn't even accept the idea that the Senate could be so arbitrary in the way it conducted that trial that it would be justiciable. The constitutional question of what was a high crime and misdemeanor, of what sort of trial the Senate could hold, was something that was dedicated to, committed to another department of government, other than the judiciary. When the president has to decide about what may or may not justify the use of military force absent a clear authorization of force by Congress, there are constitutional aspects of that sort of judgment. And we know that many of those decisions cannot be resolved by the judiciary, certainly cannot be resolved by the judiciary within the time frame that military exigency might require. But we don't say there's not a constitutional question there to be resolved. We recognize that, again, certain sorts of constitutional questions are committed to a different department within the government. They are not committed to the judiciary. They are committed to the executive branch. So in reality, if we step back and start looking at the Constitution, we should recognize that there are questions, constitutional questions, which by their nature cannot be answered by merely deferring to or waiting for the judiciary to answer them for us. And then the real question is really where the lines are, what questions can be resolved by the judiciary and what cannot. And that helps us understand why it is that the Constitution in Article 6 requires all officers to take an oath to uphold not the judgments of the Supreme Court, but to uphold the Constitution. And we expect them to discharge that. If the president is considering whether or not to veto legislation on grounds that it exceeds the constitutional authority of the federal government, right? They are not waiting for a court judgment. They hopefully are not predicting a court judgment. They are hopefully taking seriously their own oath to only play their part in making something the supreme law of the land if they have concurred with the legislature's view that it is constitutional. And similarly, the legislature, we hope, maybe this is a vain hope these days, but we certainly hope that the legislature has taken that same obligation just as seriously. But I should note that this is not just this question about what the obligations of the legislature and the executive are not simply confined to those questions that are outside of Article 3. The idea of departmentalism is that each department has the obligation in the performance of its constitutional duties to ensure that what it is doing is consistent with the Constitution. There obviously has to be some dialogue. There has to be some back and forth between the branches. But there is no abdication of that responsibility to consider the constitutional aspects of what each branch does. And it is acceptable, indeed, it is to be expected, it is a feature, not a bug, that the branches will at times disagree. It was not a constitutional problem as a structural matter that President Jefferson felt that the Constitution compelled him to pardon individuals convicted of violating the Alien and Sedition Acts, even though a court had upheld those convictions. He was fulfilling his constitutional oath. It was not a structural constitutional problem for President Lincoln to say that despite the Supreme Court's holding in Dred Scott, in the conduct of his administration, he would recognize the humanity and the citizenship of free blacks in the United States, even though the decision of Dred Scott declared such a thing to be unconstitutional and impossible. Right? That was a feature of the system, not a bug. And in some sense, we should recognize that if we take departmentalism seriously, that each department in some respects is supreme within its realm. The Supreme Court is final. There is no other court to appeal to. Right? The Facebook Oversight Board is not going to appeal the Supreme Court. But similarly, if the president vetoes a piece of legislation, the Supreme Court's not going to overturn the president. If the president says, I am vetoing this legislation because I believe it is unconstitutional, the legislature gets another shot at it, but the courts don't. The courts can't say, you were wrong about that judgment. You must undo your veto and sign it. No, we recognize that is an act that is an authority that is given to the president. And similarly, if Congress refuses to pass legislation, if Congress goes ahead with an impeachment, if Congress, that's within Congress's realm, Congress in effect is supreme at that. So if we think back to Marbury versus Madison, we think back to Chief Justice Marshall talking about is the province duty of the court to say what the law is. In the context of the Judiciary Department, in the context of resolving a dispute that is properly within the court's jurisdiction, that is absolutely true. The mistake that we make is thinking that that somehow supersedes or overcomes the equivalent obligation of the other branches to make similar judgments within their departments. And that, in a sense, is what the idea of departmentalism is about, that each branch needs to take this oath or this obligation very seriously. And what that means is that if members of Congress do not want to pass legislation because they believe it is unconstitutional, it's perfectly appropriate. I would argue it means if the executive branch does not want to enforce legislation that it believes is unconstitutional, that is appropriate. We're going to get into the duty to defend, which I think is a slightly more complicated question. I will just note that I think the real issue for an member of the executive branch who believes a law is unconstitutional, the first thing they need to consider is whether to enforce that law. The question about defending it is actually secondary. Or to get to something we'll get to later, the idea that you will enforce a law but then refuse to defend it is probably the worst possible approach. There is an argument for not enforcing it, and there is an argument for defending something that has been enforced. But the idea is that you're going to enforce it, you are going to potentially subject people to deprivation of life, liberty, or property, and then not defend it. I mean, that's in many ways perverse. Let me just say, one last point, just to note three principles that I think in practice have to inform the way we expect the branches to discharge these obligations. First, fidelity to the Constitution, fidelity to their oath. That has to be the key part. That's what we expect of officers who take a position in our government. Second one, which I think is sometimes missing in these discussions, is honesty about what really is a constitutional objection as opposed to a policy objection. The president has an obligation to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. The idea that there is a, perhaps in some circumstances, an obligation to not enforce a law that is clearly unconstitutional is not a, I just won't enforce anything I don't feel like enforcing on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. It's not a, I will just decide not to do something because I don't like it, or it violates my fundamental values because the oath is to the Constitution. And we need honesty in those discussions. We need officers who will note that not everything we really dislike is unconstitutional. And lastly, and this is the one where I think this is going to fuzz some of the edges of what I've been saying, but I think it's important, is humility. Because members of all three branches take this oath. And we generally should presume that members of all three branches are seeking to discharge their oaths in good faith and in goodwill and with seriousness. And we should expect each branch to at least pause and consider the views of their co-equal branches. We look at our founding period. This is something that James Madison talked about, right? In the fight over the National Bank, he had thought the National Bank was unconstitutional. He also reached a point where he realized that enough of his colleagues in the legislature and in the Supreme Court and elsewhere disagreed with him, that mattered, and that was something he had to consider. And that at a certain point, he had to consider it resolved for constitutional purposes. And I think that was appropriate. And there was a difference between vetoing the first bank bill and vetoing the second bill. There's a difference between raising the objection and not willing to acknowledge that others who, again, are engaged in the same enterprise, who take the same oath, may have reached a different conclusion. And I should just say, that may be the hardest principle to bring to bear in this context, but I think it's certainly important to make departmentalism work. So I will stop there, and I certainly look forward to the conversation with my co-panelists.
Great. I think Mr. Whalen is up next.
Well, thanks, Jonathan, for that very helpful overview. I agree largely, if not entirely, with everything that you said. I do want to highlight that the alternative to departmentalism is what I call the myth of judicial supremacy. The proposition that it is the obligation of all governmental actors to abide not simply by a judgment in a particular case, but by the principles the court has set forth in its rulings. Now, this is a myth that was first propagated by the Supreme Court in 1958 in the case of Cooper versus Aaron. And in that case, the court made the laughable assertion that Marbury versus Madison declared the basic principle that the federal judiciary is supreme in the exposition of the law of the Constitution. Marbury versus Madison doesn't say anything like that at all. It established a far more modest proposition that courts have the authority to decline to apply laws that they deem to be unconstitutional in the course of carrying out their duties. The court in Cooper versus Aaron also claimed that this mistaken principle that it asserted has been respected by this court and the country as a permanent and indispensable feature of our constitutional system. Well, tell that to President Jefferson, President Jackson, President Lincoln. Again, Lincoln in his first inaugural said that the ruling in Dred Scott might well bind him with respect to that case, but he was not going to apply it beyond that. He actually signed a law banning slavery in the federal territory in direct defiance of the ruling in Dred Scott. And as Jonathan indicated, he also authorized passports and patents to be issued to blacks, notwithstanding the proposition of Dred Scott that blacks could never be citizens and thus not be eligible for these privileges. And again, as Jonathan mentioned, departmentalism comes up in a whole range of contexts. I actually exercised departmentalism quite often when I was in the Office of Legal Counsel. One incident comes to mind. When I was called to attend a meeting where people were dealing with the question of whether the federal partial birth abortion bill could be then pending in Congress, whether the administration could distinguish that from the Nebraska legislation that the court had invalidated in Stenberg versus Carhart. And I get to this meeting, these attorneys are dealing with, well, we have findings here and this there. And I said, the Supreme Court got it wrong in Stenberg versus Carhart. That's our sufficient basis for saying that that the administration can support this legislation. There's a lot of vexing theoretical questions about just where you draw the boundaries. In practice, as Jonathan indicated, those questions have been sorted out through the push and pull of the branches, and that's it's not a tidy solution, but I think that's exactly what the framers anticipated, just as we see with lots of other structural constitutional questions. Now, I'm going to focus my remarks on the Department of Justice's duty to defend federal statutes against constitutional challenge in litigation. What happens, what does the Department of Justice do when a claim is made that a federal law violates the Constitution? And in this context, the questions have been much weightier in theory than in practice. Because over the course of several decades, presidential administrations with very different theoretical understandings of the president's authority to interpret the Constitution, and with very different understandings of what the Constitution means, have embraced the general proposition that the Department of Justice should vigorously defend the constitutionality of any law for which a reasonable defense may be made in the courts. Now, one big exception to that general proposition is laws that intrude on the president's constitutional prerogatives. An example here would be laws that restrict the president's removal authority. And there's a self-defense rationale against congressional aggrandizement here. We're not going to expect presidents to defend laws that are intruding on their turf. But in other contexts, administrations, again, of both parties have applied this principle. And this reasonable standard sets a very low bar. It basically means that the Department of Justice will defend a federal law against constitutional challenge when it can offer non-frivolous grounds in support of the law. And given the wide range of accepted argument in the legal profession and the breadth of interpretive methodologies among federal judges, the reasonable standard is very easy to meet. Drew Days, the former Solicitor General in the Clinton administration, explained this consensus practice by saying that it affords Congress the respect to which it is entitled as a coordinate branch of government, and also prevents the executive branch from using litigation as a form of post-enactment veto of legislation that the current administration dislikes. You can't simply say, we don't like this legislation, we're not going to defend it. And if you have an accepted practice that you defend anything that can reasonably be defended, it avoids ad hoc judgments about whether a particular law should or should not be defended. Unfortunately, in the Obama administration, there was a major departure from this basic principle. And I agree again with Jonathan's his three propositions that there ought to be fidelity, honesty, and humility. And I think the Obama administration violated all three of these when Attorney General Holder declared in 2011 that the Obama administration would no longer defend the Defense of Marriage Act, the law that for federal purposes only defined marriage as a legal union between one man and one woman as husband and wife. I'm not going to run through the details of how implausible Attorney General Holder's abandonment of DOMA was under the general standard, but again, he purported to be applying the standard that he would defend any law for which a reasonable defense could be made, but that somehow that wasn't possible for the Defense of Marriage Act. Even worse than that, even before Holder made that statement, the Obama administration had been sabotaging defense of the Defense of Marriage Act. It had announced very early in 2009 when there was an uproar when it initially adhered to the standards defending the law, that it was going to toss out, abandon rationales that had previously been successful in defending the Defense of Marriage Act, and that it condemned the law, it actually condemned in a brief as discriminatory the very law that it was purporting to defend. So this, again, I think is an example of just irresponsible, dishonest action on the part of the Obama administration. Now, again, did it have the constitutional authority to do what it did? I think it did under an understanding of departmentalism. Its constitutional theory, I think, is unsound, but I'm not arguing that it couldn't do what it did. I am arguing that it couldn't honestly do what it said it was doing. As I commented way back then, the position that the Obama administration took made it very easy. I asked back then, what happens if there's a future Republican administration, there's a challenge to Obamacare, and can the Republican administration simply say, we're not going to defend this law, we think it's unconstitutional? Well, as it happens, that's exactly what took place during the Trump administration, and I don't think that the Department of Justice's position there, which again purported to apply the same traditional standard, is any more defensible than Eric Holder's action. I will say that Holder set the stage for that. So I want to make a few other comments here before passing the baton to Attorney General Yost. One is that while it's difficult to draw the line in theory between the role of the courts and the role of the other branches, it's clear that the Supreme Court has significant institutional advantages in pressing its view of the Constitution. One reason for that is that the court has continuity over administrations. And can therefore maintain and enforce a particular view of what the Constitution means. We all know how grudging the court can sometimes be in revisiting its mistakes. It also has a whole judicial hierarchy that can enforce its view, and that, you know, Congress, mistakenly or not, has reinforced judicial supremacy by a whole system of attorney's fees that enable parties to run to court and get massive rewards if a political actor dares to try to dispute the Supreme Court's view of things. By contrast, of course, presidential administrations flip from party to party. Over the long history of the United States, it's not surprising that different parties have had different views of constitutional power, constitutional rights on a whole range of issues. Presidents tend not to spell out their theories of the Constitution in elaborate detail, it's therefore difficult to maintain a particular view of things over the long term. An exception for that is with respect to executive power, where the Office of Legal Counsel in particular has a whole set of opinions that tend to be maintained across administrations. So the same question of the responsibility of political actors to interpret the Constitution also applies to state officers. So we're talking about departmentalism at the federal level. There's something analogous at the state level. Attorney General Yost will go into that in more detail. I simply want to argue that I think that state actors also have an obligation to independently interpret the Constitution. At times, prudence will dictate that they defer to what they expect the courts will rule. But I think that they are... they have this authority. Sorry.
At the same time, I think that authority can be very much abused. And again, I can go back to during the Obama administration, I'm a resident of the state of Virginia, you had a very, very close race for attorney general in Virginia in 2013. The Democratic candidate, Mark Herring, won by under 1,000 votes.
Within days of taking office, he declared his position that Virginia's marriage laws could not be defended, and that he would not defend them. I think an outrageous position, again, under the principles that of fidelity and honesty. If he would not have been Attorney General if he'd been honest enough to let the voters know what he was going to do on that matter, and humility. And I also would argue that that the state attorney general has an obligation to defend state laws that can reasonably be defended, and that the state is his client. Now, here I humbly depart from the views that Attorney General Pryor has set forth. He maintains that the attorney general's client, I think he said this precisely, is the attorney general himself. I have great admiration for Bill Pryor. I guess would hesitate to tell him that the old saw that an attorney who represents himself as a fool for a client. But with that, I think I'll hand things off to Attorney General Yost, who might explore this last issue in more detail.
Great, General Yost.
Thank you, Your Honor. And Ed, John, both excellent remarks. In the Attorney General's office, I tell the staff that I'll pay them better and respect them more if they argue with me and criticize me, that I will not become more thoughtful or arrive at a more wise conclusion if they just tell me that they agree with me. And they take great joy in executing that admonition. So it was with some degree of apprehension that I received back the comments from Solicitor General Flowers after I drafted what I intended to present here today, because Solicitor General Flowers returned it for the first time without any edits or any criticisms. And for a moment, I felt quite good about that. I felt like perhaps a star pupil who had finally pleased his professor. But then it occurred to me that with his occasionally perverse sense of humor, that he might simply be setting me up to hoist myself on my own petard. You will be the judge. But it's a special privilege to address this question, which was raised briefly by my opponent in the 2018 campaign for Attorney General, who some of you may know was an acolyte of Eric Holder. While the question of the duty to defend does, as has been mentioned, have some pretty long whiskers, it gained modern currency in General Holder's decision not to to defend the DOMA. I will refer to that decision as the Holder Doctrine. My purpose here today is to discuss the duty to defend within the context of Ohio law and Ohio's system of governance. The Holder Doctrine has been well and thoroughly critiqued by others. My colleague, former Indiana Attorney General Greg Zeller, in his 2015 article in the Indiana Law Journal, did a thorough job rebutting it, and that requires no further elucidation by me. In summary, Zeller points out that declining to defend a statute creates a de facto veto, that it undercuts the popularly elected branch charged with lawmaking, and opens the door to somewhat endless political motivation and mischief. To these critiques, I would only add that it increases the risk of unwise outcomes. In a legislative body, one must convince a majority of its members to adopt an unwise outcome. Surely not an impossible task, but it seems more likely that a single attorney general might err than a majority of a larger assembly. Though, again, perhaps it depends on the particular attorney general and the particular legislative body. Ohio, like most states, does not place an explicit duty on its attorney general to defend. The Ohio Constitution really describes the AG as the chief law officer of the state, and the revised code simply designates the AG as counsel to the state government and its officers and agencies. In order to understand what duty to defend, if any, might be implied by this designation, it's first necessary to understand the role of the Attorney General. The federal government has a unitary executive under the direction of the president. Therefore, an Attorney General only has the independence granted to her by the president or limited in limited instances as specified by Congress. Therefore, however intellectually fragile the Holder Doctrine might be, as a practical matter, General Holder really had no option but to follow the direction of his president on the defense question. Most state governments, including Ohio, do not have a unitary executive, but a divided executive. The Attorney General is not appointed by the governor, but elected independently by the voters in the same election as the governor. Since the Ohio Attorney General is independent of the chief executive, the AG has to make a series of decisions unrelieved by the stratagem of blaming it on the boss. What is that duty? And once the duty is defined, how is it to be fulfilled? A duty to defend can certainly be imposed by law. Mississippi, for example, has such a statute. Absent explicit authority, which is the case in Ohio, one must look to the implications of the system as a whole. Ohio unambiguously grants the legislative power to the General Assembly in its constitution. And for the record, in Ohio, the governor is not a member of the legislature. It also grants a role in that to the governor to check it by a veto, and in turn, that is checked by the override provisions. There is no mention of any role whatsoever for the Attorney General in the lawmaking process. If the Attorney General were meant to have a veto, the Constitutional Convention could easily have written in such a power. Sovereignty, of course, resides in the people themselves. The General Assembly, the governor, and the Attorney General are all merely officers operating under the authority delegated to them by the sovereign. This arrangement implies, at the very least, that the work product of that delegated authority must be defended against challenges in court unless it is patently and unambiguously unconstitutional on its face, say a statute that would deprive women of the right to vote. If the legislative work product is not defended, why have a legislature to begin with? So we have decided that such a duty exists, at least by necessary implication. The next question that has to be answered is, who executes that duty? As chief law officer of the state, it would seem that such a duty would fall to the Attorney General, logically. And to the answer to that question, we must consider another question familiar to any lawyer, I see many here, who do handle complex matters. Who is the client? The AG's client is not the officers and agencies of the state of Ohio. It is the people of Ohio themselves, the sovereign. The state officers and agencies are employees of the client, granted primary power with respect to their individual policy spheres, but nonetheless employees. The independently elected AG represents those employees' bosses. In most cases, even if the Attorney General doubts the wisdom of a particular matter, he or she ought to directly fulfill the duty to defend. And that's because the people who have delegated those policy decisions to to the governor and to the General Assembly, and the Attorney General is not free to substitute individual policy preferences, but where the AG believes a matter to be unconstitutional rather than merely unwise, the AG's duty runs to the client, to the people. And here we run smack dab into the problem of what's been called litigation veto, a single person overriding the judgment of all other officers, all other coordinate branches of government, and allowing the law to be slaughtered by the plaintiff's counsel alone, unarmed and undefended. As former AG Zeller and others have argued, this proposition lacks a limiting principle, which every good Federalist knows is a petri dish growth medium for tyranny. I would argue that the limiting principle, though, is the duty to defend. Where a conflict of duties arises, much more than just a conflict of interest, it is incumbent upon the lawyer to address it and not ignore it. Where the Attorney General has determined that his client's interest, represented by the directly ratified Constitution, requires defense of the Constitution and not the challenged litigation, outside counsel must be appointed to defend the legislation. There is then no litigation veto. The question reaches the courts, is fully heard and decided by a coordinate and co-equal branch of government. Now, some critics might object that this reading undermines the doctrine of the separation of powers, but the AG is not acting in this instance as a judicial officer, but as an advocate. The AG is not a gatekeeper here, because independent counsel will prevent that default judgment against an undefended statute. Access to the courts is not impeded, as it would be under a unitary executive employing the Holder Doctrine. Neither is judicial review impaired. It's actually enhanced by able advocacy of competing viewpoints. If the courts were to place some additional credibility on the opinion of the Attorney General, which candidly is not my experience in this office, it might be justified by the fact that the people have reserved to themselves independent legal representation in Ohio for 170 years. Now, the discretion I'm describing in the role of the Attorney General, limited by the duty to provide independent counsel to defend, may feel uncomfortable to some of us. As a general rule, unfettered discretion has produced distasteful results when mixed with government power, specifically executive power, from Henry II to today's presidential love affair with executive orders. Yet, with this limitation, the AG's discretion is discretion of advocacy, not discretion of action. The AG may not stand in the courthouse, doors denying admittance and hearing. And recognizing the AG's duty to the sovereign to defend the Constitution produces this benefit. It gives the people a voice in court. Legislation, as we've said, must be defended as a product of the Republican system of government, or self-rule means nothing. Individuals and organizations harmed by legislation in derogation of the Constitution must also have access to the courts for redress, or again, the Constitution is meaningless. But neither of these necessarily defend the Constitution itself, and we properly discourage courts from bringing in arguments not raised by the parties in the dispute themselves. Recognizing the Attorney General's role in representing the people within the constraints argued ensures that necessary arguments will be raised before the court, even if those arguments are not in the interest of the individual litigants. The people are the unseen, unheard, and oftentimes uninvited party in every interest, in every constitutional challenge. It's decidedly, thank you, Justice Marshall, the role of the Attorney General to defend them. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you. Those were terrific presentations. And Ed, I hope everyone could hear your remarks. I think we got your mic fixed. My recollection is it cut out just after your sort of veiled criticism of the Trump administration's decision not to defend the ACA.
But I heard them. They were really good.
I promise I had nothing to do with the microphone. Well, tell you what, maybe Jonathan, Ed, would you want to respond to General Yost's comments, and then we can open up to some more general questions?
Yeah, just a quick response to both presentations. Just a couple of things I want to put on the table. I mentioned, at least for me, what I think are important: fidelity, honesty, and humility when thinking about this question of how each department should discharge its responsibilities. A fourth principle, which might be implicit in the first three or perhaps deserves its own billing, would be consistency. And I think one of the things that, at least my diagnosis of part of what Ed identified, is the problem of selective decision about when to stand on the constitutional value. And so, for example, if an administration believes that there is no constitutional argument that, say, a particular federal statute is within the enumerated powers of the federal government, I'm okay with that if they are not enforcing it and they are applying a similar standard to every like statute. I, shall we say, am a bit skeptical that either of the prior two administrations could say that that was their approach to what they would and would not defend, and rather politics entered into it. I think that is a problem. On the point about non-enforcement, I think it's real quick example. Let's say there's a jurisdiction where there's a law that authorizes, under certain circumstances, government officials to summarily seize property without any sort of process, without even the fig leaf of process that we provide in the civil forfeiture context today. And the Attorney General of that jurisdiction decided that that statute is unconstitutional. It violates the U.S. Constitution. It would be unconscionable for that jurisdiction to say, well, the way we're going to handle that is we're going to go ahead and take people's property in accordance with that law, and then if they bother to sue, we just won't defend it. That was, in fact, what the IRS did to Edith Windsor. That is backwards, right? If after considering the need to recognize the views of the other branches, to recognize the weight of history with the proper humility, the conclusion is nonetheless that a law is clearly unconstitutional, well, then it should not be enforced. People should not be deprived of their liberty under that law, and to do so is to violate the oath that is required by Article 6 of the Constitution. And so, you know, I think one way to evaluate prior administrations, federal and state level, who have selectively decided not to enforce certain statutes or not defend them, is, are they really being consistent? Or are they merely, or does it appear that they are doing what appears to be politically or otherwise expedient in terms of what they enforce and what they defend? And in terms of Attorney General Yost's remarks, you know, I appreciate the very thoughtful remarks, and especially the highlighting the fact that the state level and the federal level, the underlying questions and the way some concept like departmentalism applies are different. And the key, of course, is that you don't have the same sort of unitary executive structure at the state level in most states that you do at the federal level. And as I tell my students in both LegReg and in admin, that has a lot of implications for a lot of doctrines. And I'm concerned in a lot of recent litigation, in a lot of states, there hasn't been enough consideration about how certain concepts and principles that we think apply a particular way at the federal level properly apply differently at the state level. And I think this is one of them. My concern with Attorney General Yost's remarks is Article 6 of the Constitution says that all state officers take an oath to uphold the Constitution. And I believe that oath takes precedence over the Attorney General's obligation to the people that elected the Attorney General. And I think that has to be part of the calculus. Now, I happen to think there are ways of dealing with that that avoid concerns about opportunistic failure to defend, which is a very serious concern and one that all Attorney Generals should take seriously. I know when Mike DeWine was Attorney General, There was one case where his office filed had two teams of lawyers filed two separate briefs. That was something that Robert Bork, Solicitor General, had done in the Justice Department as well. Whether that's the right way to deal with that or not, I'm not sure. But I do think that if the Attorney General takes an oath to the Constitution, then that is binding, and that the Attorney General cannot advance arguments in defense of a state statute or state referendum state action that the Attorney General is convinced directly violate that oath. I think the Attorney General can take steps to make sure that that statute or that referendum still is defended. And I think that is consistent with the Attorney General's obligations to the people. But I think that oath is ultimately the guide. And again, humility and the like, you know, due regard to the judgment of the people in a referendum, due regard for the judgment of coordinate branches of government play a role in that calculus. But if the ultimate conclusion is this is clearly unconstitutional, I think the oath must control.
A couple comments on Jonathan's remarks. First, on the Defense of Marriage Act, the Obama administration continued to enforce the act while declining to defend it. They basically wanted to make sure that the courts would strike it down, and if they were worried that if they didn't enforce it, there wouldn't be justiciable litigation. I disagree with Jonathan about the significance of the oath. Look, all of you have taken an oath to, as members of the Ohio Bar to abide by and defend the federal constitution as well as the state constitution. That doesn't prevent you from making arguments in good faith that a law violates or is consistent with the federal constitution. And I think Jonathan's argument about the oath goes too far. Federal officers obviously take that as well. So I think there's plenty of room for a state AG consistent with the oath to argue that a state law is constitutionally permissible, even if in his own best judgment he thinks that the courts would strike it down. I think Jonathan probably agrees with that if it's just a matter of predicting what the courts would do. If we go a step further and say, even if he believes that the best reading of the Constitution is that the law is unconstitutional, again, I think comparing him, viewing him as an attorney for his client, I don't know that he's any different from the rest of you advancing the cause for your client. Now, to be sure, the oath here is, well, the oath for state officers, what exactly does the Constitution say, Jonathan, on this?
It says, senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the several state legislatures and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution.
Okay, so the question would be whether the fact that the oath is set forth in the Constitution as opposed to, say, Ohio's statute makes a difference. In terms of Attorney General Yost's remarks, as I think I made clear, I broadly agree with his position.
Your Honor, I wonder if I might draw one slight clarification here. When I say that the Attorney General's client is the people, I want to make something very clear, because that rhetoric has been used by some of my colleagues around the country to arrogate to themselves the role of spokesman for the people. And I think that is a very dangerous argument to make without any limitation. My argument is narrower. My argument is that the people of the state, having ratified this organic document of the Constitution, have expressed their understanding of the checks and balances and how our government is going to operate and what their rights are. And so it's not a matter of projecting my political beliefs or understanding on what the people want, but rather defending the Constitution being the expressed understanding through ratification of the people. So I don't think an attorney general is free to simply impute what the people want based on election returns or personal beliefs.
Great. One distinction between our federal system and our state system, I know from experience that Congress passed a statute, 28 U.S.C. 530D, that requires the executive branch to notify Congress if it's not going to defend a law. And so you could read that by implication to think that at least Congress understood that sometimes the executive branch would not defend one of the acts that they've passed. I don't think Ohio, I'm not sure that Ohio has a similar requirement, and I'm not sure what happens in that context, but that might be one distinction between the two. But one question, maybe for Jonathan, if we are going to have executives in the business of picking and choosing sometimes which laws to defend, how do we avoid the problem of the decision just looking political? Because these are, most of the time, these are fairly high profile laws that have significant policy implications. And if with a simple rule that the executive will defend, that sort of takes in some ways the political calculus out of things. So how do we avoid the problem of every one of these situations, whether it's the Obama administration, Trump administration, or Biden administration, looking like they're just making a political decision with a legal overlay?
Well, I mean, sometimes they do look like that because that's what they're doing. I mean, I don't, Ed and I don't disagree, for example, on how the Obama administration treated DOMA. And I'll say, you know, I was on a brief that argued that DOMA was unconstitutional, not for the reasons the court found. I just don't think it was within the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8. But nonetheless, you know, their position was not, we're not going to enforce it. Right? I mean, you know, individuals, according to the administration's position was, we are going to unconstitutionally take people's property because of through the tax laws, through marriages that federal law doesn't recognize. But if they sue us, we will roll over and not defend that and see whether or not Congress can figure out how to defend it. I mean, again, that is transparently political. It is trying to manipulate the court system to produce an outcome. It is not, I am an executive official, and as try as I might to see what Congress may have thought about when it enacted this law nearly unanimously, and it was signed into law by a Democratic president, I still can't see how this reasonably could be understood as constitutional, right? So that's the kind of the humility that's involved in thinking through that question. That wasn't what was going on, right? And I think we can see that. So I recognize it's a problem. I think in general, we have a broader problem of government officials not distinguishing enough between what are their policy views and what are constitutional obligations. And that problem is no less here. But it is a serious problem. But I do think pointing out that the duty to defend is secondary to the question of whether or not you're going to enforce the law is part of it. Because to say you're not going to enforce it, I think actually in most cases takes more fortitude than to say now that it is a high profile issue, I'm going to give some press conference and say, oh yeah, well, we're not going to defend this, right? But to actually not enforce on the ground, well, that's more significant. And I think accordingly, right, the examples of that historically on constitutional grounds are much fewer. And we should have that discussion about, you know, what the take care obligation is and how the take care obligation requires enforcing all laws that you think are that you believe are not clearly unconstitutional. So that's how I would address that. But you know, if the concern is in our current moment, are politicians going to be opportunistic? Yes. I mean, I don't have an answer to that. But I think we need to think through about, you know, what are the standards we should expect public officials to aspire to and that we should try and hold them to. And I think this is one of them. Right? We elect them to, among other things, take the oath seriously and discharge it as best they can, not to, you know, play games with it.
Well, part of the problem we have here is just a deep divide over what the Constitution means and over how to interpret it. And so we see that in the political arena, and we see that deep divide play out. One of the areas in which departmentalism applies is so-called presidential signing statements. That is, so when an enacted bill is presented to the president, the president will sometimes say that I'm going to sign this bill into law, but in doing so, I regard Section 4 as unconstitutional, and I am not going to enforce it and going to direct my subordinates not to apply it. There was a huge uproar, seems like yesterday, but I guess some of you may be too young to remember this, in the George W. Bush administration over presidential signing statements. There was a wild claim actually endorsed by an ABA committee that presidential signing statements were themselves unconstitutional. This is a practice that dated back to George Washington, and you had this highly politicized ABA committee not recognizing that the issue is whether the particular objections raised are sound or not. That's where the debate should be, not over the practice of presidential signing statements. Then President Obama comes into office and ends up making a whole series of objections and signing statements on many of the same grounds that George W. Bush did, and there's silence from the ABA and a lot of the critics of the Bush practice. So there is, it's not just that politicians are opportunistic, a lot of the legal profession is as well.
I will say, I don't like signing statements. I'll go on the record. I don't like signing statements. If the statement is, if the law is interpreted in this way, then it's okay, but not in this other way, because there are two plausible interpretations, one that is constitutional, one that it's not, I'm okay with it. If it's, there's a piece of legislation and there is a part of it that is unconstitutional, I'm in the camp that the president should veto it and send it back and say to Congress, send me two separate bills or change it or whatever. I think it is a violation of the oath to affix the presidential signature to a piece of legislation that has no plausible constitutional interpretation.
Jonathan, appropriations bills ever since Chadha have continued to have the legislative veto. You're going to just veto every piece of legislation? It seems to me it's entirely consistent with the president's duty to take care that that the laws be faithfully executed, to say that he will enforce or execute those parts of a law that are constitutional permissible and not those that aren't.
This actually raises an interesting question that is larger than the federal government. The issue is the discretion that's exercised in blanket authority. So we have a similar kind of discretion in prosecution enforcement of laws called prosecutorial discretion. And what we've seen lately from progressive prosecutors is instead of taking an individual case, determining that the law as applied to these facts would produce an unjust or perverse result and declining the prosecution, they are now adopting entire classes of offenses, for example, prostitution or misdemeanor theft or panhandling, and declining to prosecute any cases under any kind of fact pattern. And this is part and parcel of the same thing we're talking about, which is the derogation of the people to enact laws through their elected assemblies and not have them overturned unilaterally by executive fiat. So thank you for letting me add that.
Of course, you're the panelists. But we do have time for questions from the audience. So if anyone has a question, feel free to line up behind the professor.
Can you hear me?
I say we don't have markers to tell you how far 6 feet is, so I just encourage you to use your best judgment.
6 feet from the microphone?
You're probably okay there. I'm not Dr. Fauci, but if anyone else wants to line up behind you, they're welcome to do that as well, so we can hear from some of you also. So, Professor.
All right. I'm David Forte from Cleveland State. I rise to try to solve this problem so we can all go home happy. It seems to me, in terms of the president enforcing a law, there are three options. He may decide not to enforce a law because it intrudes upon his core constitutional powers, such as commander-in-chief, into which Congress may not intrude. And if you look at most of the signing statements, whether it's President Trump or President Obama or President Bush, they're almost identical in that regard. They're usually in regard to defense appropriations. It seems to me the president's fully within his constitutional power to refuse to be bullied by Congress in an area where it is constitutionally exclusive to him. On the other side, it seems to me totally contrary to the president's oath faithfully to execute the laws, to decide not to execute a law because he doesn't like the policy. That puts aside Congress's appropriate legislative power. In the middle, you have the problem of the president deciding not to enforce a law because he doesn't think it is constitutional. My view is that he has no right to do that. He has had his constitutional shot in terms of the veto, or the previous president had it in terms of the veto. And for him then to supplant the legal processes because he doesn't think it's constitutional seems to me to violate his oath of office. And it doesn't solve the problem. I told you I'm solving things. It doesn't solve the problem to say, well, the president takes an oath of office to the Constitution. He takes an oath to the Constitution that limits him as well. It's not an oath to decide who's done constitutional items or not. Dred Scott's sui generis. I mean, that we can put aside, but I'll talk to you about that later. So I want to do this, ask you about this Jackson tripartite view about whether the president can fail to execute if it intrudes upon his core powers, whether he can fail to execute if he doesn't like the policy, and whether he can fail to execute because he thinks the law is unconstitutional. There's my question.
Thank you.
Well, I don't buy it in the end. I mean, on your third, you initially said, oh, he had his chance to veto, or his predecessor did. Well, there's a big difference between those. Insofar as you're trying to invoke some sort of forfeiture or waiver, obviously it doesn't apply if this is a law that his predecessor signed. So, I think the... I don't buy your third category. I don't think there's a resolution there. I think that's where the difficulty is.
I'm going to say I don't buy the third category for a slightly different reason. I mean, I think for me, I think that's what the value of humility is, and that's the role that it plays. Because I don't think Dred Scott is sui generis in that there are not instances in which Congress has enacted clearly unconstitutional laws that are so out of bounds that the president, even after considering as best he can the views of the legislature, cannot convince himself are constitutional. And so I don't think there is a category of one. I don't think Lincoln is the only president to have been justified to say, I'm not going to enforce it. Because not enforcing is a larger step than not defending, I'm less concerned about presidents simply doing that. And again, humility, I think, is part of what plays that role. The fact that Congress enacted something, the fact that Congress enacted something over a veto, the fact that a prior president may have signed it, the fact that part of the Constitution that the president takes the oath to also obligates the president to faithfully execute the laws are all reasons why the president should consider this to be a very solemn choice. But I don't think, outside of intrusion on executive power, the category of laws that a president would be justified in not enforcing is a category of one. As a result of Dred Scott. Last thing I'll say, there is a fourth category, that is to say Congress enacts more laws than it gives the executive branch the resources and ability to enforce. And I think it is, an important codicil to the point that Attorney General Yost made about what we see some prosecutors doing, which is saying, I'm not going to enforce any of law X in my jurisdiction, even though it's still on the books. That is a problem. It's not a problem for the prosecutor to say, well, we've got 50 laws and I've got enough, you know, officers and prosecutors and whatever to only prosecute X percent of the violations. And so here is a loose sense of the rank order of those, because until the legislature gives me the resources to enforce all the laws, I have to set priorities. That's reasonable. That's different, I think, than what some of the prosecutors at Attorney General Yost was referring to. But I think that's a widespread phenomenon today, right? Congress's appetite for the things it wants to prohibit or require is far greater than its willingness to appropriate funds for enforcement.
One final quibble, David. Your third category also doesn't deal with enactments via congressional override of vetoes. congressional override of vetoes. I mean, it also doesn't deal with that. No, I'm saying if a president vetoes a legislation, Congress overrides the veto, the legislation is enacted. Is your argument that the president and his successors have an obligation to? Okay, it doesn't follow on your implicit forfeiture principle.
All right, we'll go to the next question.
Thanks. Tom Lantman from West Virginia. The panel discussed a lot about departmentalism in the defensive context, but I wonder kind of how that plays out in the offensive context. I'm thinking particularly about state AGs. You know, for the last decade or so, we've seen a lot of, on both sides of the aisle, state attorneys general, proactively going after things enacted by the People's Assembly at the federal level that they believe are unconstitutional, or actions by the federal executive that they believe are unconstitutional. So I'd be interested to hear the panel's thoughts on how that should that analysis be thought of differently when it's state versus federal, or how do those factors play out when it's state versus federal in that context?
I would argue it's perfectly appropriate for state attorneys general or anyone else to seek to correct erroneous judicial judgments by bringing cases that ask the courts to reach the proper constitutional result. Where I think we have a problem is that standing doctrine has become too permissive for states and have made it too easy for states to assert injuries that aren't there or that are not, should not be cognizable under Article 3, but that's a separate issue. But the fact that state attorneys general are saying we have gone off track constitutionally and we are going to bring litigation to try and bring us back on track is perfectly appropriate, as is a legislature enacting a law that it knows the courts will reject in the hope that they can convince the courts to change their mind. I mean, that's part of the way the process works, and that's part of how we get constitutional change, because the Supreme Court's not going to reconsider stuff unless it has a case before it where it can.
I would say, as a twist maybe on that question, is there an extra obligation on a state attorney general to defend a state law when it's attacked under the federal constitution that's not maybe implicit, or the stakes aren't quite as high when the federal executive decides not to defend a federal law that's attacked under the federal constitution? In other words, are there some federalism concerns at all that come to mind for anyone? Or,
well, again, there is no duty, I think, at any level to defend a patently unconstitutional statute. But what I mean by patently unconstitutional is what A.G. Zeller talked about, a argument that's so frivolous it wouldn't pass a Rule 11 test, that there's no good faith basis for arguing it. And the reason I specifically chose women's suffrage is we've got an explicit amendment to the Constitution ratified by the states that establishes that. It's impossible for there to be a good faith argument for a state statute that would abrogate that. On the other hand, and this goes back a little bit to the argument that Ed made, an existing Supreme Court precedent that establishes law says what the Constitution says, it explains the Constitution or applies it, but it's not the Constitution itself. So I don't see any ethical problem or any duty problem in defending that statute where there is a good faith basis for an extension of the law or for reconsideration of existing court precedent. I hope that distinction seems to be clear.
I think I would go even further than you on this. That is, I think ultimately it's a matter of a prudential judgment. I don't think you need to have a good faith view that existing precedent would allow the law, because the existing precedent may be entirely unconstitutional. Take Roe, for example. So if you have a legislation, say, that bans abortion after 15 weeks. That is legislation that is not going to be upheld under existing the precedent. And I think it's very difficult to have a good faith belief otherwise. Nonetheless, I don't think you're acting in violation of your oath in defending such law. You might be acting imprudently if you're incurring massive attorney's fees liability for your state in defending it.
Yes, and if I misstated that, I apologize. We, in fact, are defending some statutes here in Ohio that many lawyers would look at as being inconsistent with existing precedent. Dred Scott is a great example of the fact that it's also a legitimate thing to look at litigation that's designed to overturn or revisit existing precedent.
Probably have time for one last question and maybe a short question and relatively short answers, and we'll wrap up.
We'll do my best. Patrick Lewis, hello. just wondering what the panel thinks about to overcome the litigation veto problem. I know in a lot of states there have been movements toward trying to expand legislative standing to have the legislature come in to defend its statute when the executive won't. Or we've also had instances where third parties have come in, intervened in litigation to defend statutes the executive would not defend. So when it comes to overcoming litigation veto, what do the panelists think about the ability of either legislators or third parties to come in if the executive will not?
Yeah, this was a big issue in the Prop 8 case out of California, if I heard the question accurately. And there the court ultimately held that the defenders of Prop 8 did not have authority under state law to defend the law, and they ruled against them on that basis. I think it would be a very good idea for state legislatures to confer state law authority have some sort of mechanism to make sure that a law was defended if a state attorney general decides not to defend it. And I gather from what you said before, you would agree with that?
I agree that the law as legislative product ought to be defended by the attorney general or through an alternative counsel. I'm not sure that I'm willing to go so far as to say that let the legislature is a party to the litigation.
And I'm not so much suggesting the legislature as a party, though I suppose that is an option, but rather that there be some neutral law in existence, ex ante, that says that in a particular instance, when the attorney general fails to defend a law, someone else has authority under state law to do so. And again, I think this is substantively neutral because who knows who would be the attorney general and on what cause he or she would be failing to defend the law.
I agree.
A couple of quick thoughts. I mean, that's generally going to be a question of state law if we're talking about state statutes. And so we may get, I know Judge Sutton's no longer here, but we may get 50 different answers to that, and that's fine. There's a particular concern when you're talking about referenda. I think the opportunistic failure to defend concern cuts a little differently when you're talking about the failure to defend a referendum, because there are reasons why politicians might selectively not want to defend actions taken by the people to discipline politicians. And so I think the considerations there are slightly different, but still would be a question under state law. Last thing I'll note, if the issue is non-enforcement, I'm not sure deputizing someone either is a good idea or in many cases even really works, right? That is to say, just as the Supreme Court is supreme within the judicial department, right, in the sense that there is no appeal beyond that, and that the judgment of the court will bind the parties to that case, and the remedies the court has the authority to order will bind the parties. If the executive decides not to enforce well, then there was likely not to be someone who would be injured or in a position to challenge it. And that may mean that a law does not get challenged and does not get litigated. And that's okay. And I think it's the corollary to what occurs in the judiciary. And yes, it allows for error. The courts can reach the wrong judgment. An executive can wrongly conclude that a law cannot constitutionally be enforced. But that's the nature of the system, and ultimately, I think it's a feature more than a bug.
And a subsequent executive can choose to enforce the law.
Yes.
Great. This was a terrific panel. Please join me in thanking the panelists.
Thank you all for coming today. And especially, I'd like to thank our amazing panelists, moderators, and speakers. What do you say? Shall we meet here again? Same place, same time, say next Friday, and do it all over again? All right, we've saved a treat for you for last. For our final act, we have a very compelling closer. Justice Pat DeWine began his 6-year term on the Supreme Court of Ohio in January 2017. He is an excellent writer who is known for the quality and thoroughness of his legal opinions. His opinions reflect his strong belief in judicial restraint and his respect for the constitutional roles of the other co-equal branches of government. We in Ohio look the other way at the one grave misjudgment he has made in his life, attending that law school up north. He did graduate Order of the Coif honors, so we'll let it slide this time. As an undergraduate student at Miami University, he was a member of the varsity track and cross-country teams. He clerked for the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals for Judge David Nelson, and we're honored to have him offering closing remarks for what has been a very special conference today. Please join me in welcoming Justice Pat DeWine.
Thank you all very much. It's my honor to close what has been a great conference. I can't tell you how genuinely good it is to see all of you and to be with all of you, not on Zoom, but actually in person. I don't think any of us are ever going to take for granted again the kind of back of the room chit-chat, the in the hallway conversations. There's such a part of these events. And certainly, congratulations, Robert, on putting together a great conference. Congratulations to Lisa Ezel and everyone at the National Federalist Society and everyone at the state for making this what I think has really been a great conference. I think Judge Rogers, your speech was fantastic. All the panels were great, so thank you all. It's kind of fun to look around this room. I think I have 9 clerks here, nine either former, current, or future clerks here. And I know it's nothing like the number of bat shelter clerks in the room, but I still feel like I'm doing something pretty well in the hiring process to see that. I know what you're all thinking. As soon as DeWine shuts up, the bar opens. So I'll try to keep this brief. But I do love being part of these events. To me, what makes the Federalist Society so great is this emphatic rejection of the notion that there's one orthodoxy of thought that we all must accept. Really, that's the idea that animates our Constitution. When our framers looked to history, they saw from their standpoint that the greatest threats to individual liberty had come from powerful central governments and sometimes from state-backed religious monoliths. So they wrote a Constitution that divided powers between the branches of government, between the states and the federal government, and they gave us a Bill of Rights that by its very First Amendment guaranteed freedom of speech and freedom of religion. At their core, these constitutional freedoms have one thing in common: the protection of the individual's right not to go with the flow, the right to reason, to think, to argue, to debate, and come to one's own conclusions about what is right or wrong, what is true and untrue, and how one wants to order his or her life. Of course, As Judge Sutton always points out to us, a key part of our freedom-protecting constitutional order is that diffusion of power between states and the federal government. As a state Supreme Court, we further those interests by independently interpreting our Ohio Constitution based upon its own unique text, history, and tradition, not by simply acting in lockstep with the U.S. Supreme Court interpretations of similar federal provisions. And even when it comes to the U.S. Constitution, our duty is to apply our independent perspective until the United States Supreme Court tells us otherwise. I'm proud, for example, that last year, four members of the Ohio Supreme Court, and that's a majority, by the way, did something that I don't think a single federal circuit has done. We rejected the use of an interest balancing test, intermediate scrutiny, that relegated the Second Amendment to a second-class right. Instead, we said that laws that burden the Second Amendment must be evaluated based upon the history, text, and tradition of that amendment. As lawyers and judges, we devote our efforts to the legal arena. But increasingly, the greatest threats to freedom come not so much from government, sometimes from government, often government, but also from powerful societal actors intent on imposing their own orthodoxy of thought. Take freedom of expression. If you look at precedent from the United States Supreme Court, you look at precedent from our court, at no point in our history have there been greater legal protections against government restrictions on speech. But at the same time, the actual ability of citizens to express themselves is increasingly under assault. You can do a lot of cool things when you're on the Ohio Supreme Court, but you can't overrule a judgment of the Facebook Court of Appeals. No question, as Justice Thomas reminded us recently, we're all going to have to grapple in coming years with how our legal doctrines apply in a world where the public square is increasingly being replaced by privately owned platforms. But we also have an obligation to defend the values that underlie our Constitution outside of the courtroom. When it comes to freedom of expression, it took a while to get things right. Despite the sweeping language of the First Amendment, its promise was not fully realized until really the 1960s when the United States Supreme Court read the amendment to afford broad protections to those who criticized the government. In doing so, the court embraced the marketplace of ideas metaphor that had been developed four decades earlier by Justices Holmes and Brandeis. As Holmes explained, when one is certain in their beliefs, then persecution of others for contrary opinions is perfectly logical. But when one realizes that time has upset many, many fighting faiths, one also realizes that ultimate good is better accomplished by the free trade of ideas. When the court adopted that conception, it acted in accord with really the prevailing views of other societal institutions, particularly academia and the news media. Today, though, it seems our judicial system is often on its own in insisting on the efficacy of allowing the unbridled expression of out-of-favor opinions. No one has a bigger stake, for example, than the media in the free exchange of ideas. But more and more, it seems even the media is less than comfortable with the implications of a true marketplace of ideas. Consider, for example, the New York Times editorial of June 25th, 1978. That was the day that the Nazis had planned to march in predominantly Jewish Skokie, Illinois. Here's what the Times editorial page wrote that day. I quote, "As for the Nazis, let them march. Nothing they will do or say is likely to win them the affection of any number of Americans. But the fact that they are permitted to rally confirms the strength of the constitutional government, which they would, if they could, destroy." Now, is there anyone in this room that believes that the New York Times editorial board would have the courage to write those words today? Indeed, contrast that with what happened last summer at the Times, when a New York Times opinion editor dared allow a United States senator's viewpoint, Tom Cotton's, to be published on the editorial page. The backlash that erupted and mostly we read from younger, I guess, woke staffers, the New York Times, was so severe that that editor who dared to treat the opinion page, the place where you air divergent opinions, was forced to resign. And I think things are even worse when it comes to our universities, colleges. One need only pick up a newspaper, scroll through a few judicial opinions, just read one from the Sixth Circuit, or chat with a college student to realize how out of favor the marketplace of idea is in many of our academic institutions. A few years ago, I got invited to speak on Law Day to one of Ohio's most storied liberal arts colleges. I won't name it, but you can probably figure out which one. It's a place that has a history of dissent. It was a bastion of abolitionism dating from well back before the Civil War. I think so I gave my speech about First Amendment values to an audience that was respectful, but decidedly skeptical. After I finished, it was time for questions. A professor raised his hand. Justice DeWine, you base much of what you say on the U.S. Constitution. That Constitution is premised on principles of Western liberalism, principles that at this point in our history have long since been firmly discredited. How can you continue to defend those ideas? Needless to say, I didn't share the professor's view of history, and I emphatically said so, but you do have to worry about the long-term implications for our First Amendment freedoms when important societal institutions increasingly reject the idea that truth is best reached through the free competition of ideas. Though the marketplace of ideas may be under attack, it is far superior to the imposition of some chosen orthodoxy from on high. The First Amendment, by its terms, applies only to government conduct. But the logic of the marketplace of ideas, the values that underlie our First Amendment, apply with equal force to private conduct, be it a social networking platform, academia, or a newspaper editorial page. I hope that our institutions will come to learn what our legal system has learned through time, that there's no guarantee that any one of us is right, so that it's worth putting up with voices we don't like in order to ensure we are able to say and to hear what we choose. To the extent they don't, however, it's going to be even more important that our courts continue to protect the right of unpopular voices to be heard. But in this age, it is also important what happens outside the courtroom. So let me just close by challenging all of you. Continue to fight for our constitutional values, fight for them inside the courtroom, but also fight for them outside the courtroom. Thank you all very much. I think, I guess Lisa, you, third, I think the bar is almost open, so it's been great to be here.